Now, to get us started today, I want to ask you to just be a sport with me and participate by answering a certain question, okay? A very simple question that I want to ask you to think about right in the comfort of your seat. You don't have to get up. You don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything, but just consider this question with me just very, very briefly. And here it is. Is that whenever you hear the word believe, what comes to mind? What is it that comes to mind for you? Now, I understand that right now, here we are in our context, is we're at church. We just finished singing songs about God, praying, and now I'm talking about Him. So, probably right now, for you and for all of us, something spiritual may come to mind. But let's take Monday through Saturday, this past week or any other given week, and think about how maybe believe or belief shows up in your everyday context. Does it possibly show up for you in a way to where possibly that as you think about the organization you work for, or maybe an organization that you're affiliated with, that as you think about their mission, their values, their leadership, and what they do, that for you, you say, I believe in that organization. Is it possibly like that? I think that happens for many of us. Or could it be that there's a person or a group of people? Maybe it's a leader. Maybe it's a philanthropist. Maybe it's a family member. That it's someone that you have the deepest level of respect for. That the things that they stand for, the things that they do, the things that they're about, that when you think about them, you say, I believe in that person. Or could it be even just the practical things of life? That maybe the hair care product that you have used for many, many years and on many occurrences that gives you just that special swoop to your hair that you continue to use, that you think to yourself, I believe in that product. You know, when you think about belief, isn't it true that belief just permeates every category in our lives? Every category. And just to make sure that we're all on the same page thinking about belief and what it is, let me give you a textbook definition of how belief is defined. Here's what they say. Belief is a psychological state in which an individual holds a proposition or premise to be true. That's what belief is. Belief is something that takes place in your mind, and it is a proposition or a premise that takes place in all of our lives that we hold to as being true. That's how you define belief. So when you think about belief and you think about all of us, every one of us walk around in life each and every day with a core set of beliefs. Beliefs of things or factors and things that we hold to be true. And the way that I know this is true is by just sharing with you a couple of examples and just seeing what this stirs inside of you. Whenever you hear the word politics, whether you're watching CNN or Fox, depending on if you are more conservative or a little more liberal, that whenever you hear politics, what you believe about politics tells you what you hold is true about that subject. And here's what you may believe. Some of you may believe that politics is a squeaky clean career path and that everyone should do it, right? Or some of you may believe that politics is probably one of the filthiest, dirtiest things you could ever get mixed up in, and that's how you feel about it. Not only do you think about it in your beliefs about politics, what about when you hear the word marriage or the Institute of Marriage? For some of us here, we have certain beliefs about marriage, that it's just a waste of time, maybe, not something to be entered into lightly. Or for others, you may think it's the best thing in the world. The same is true with love, that when you think about love, you have beliefs about love. When you think about money, you have certain beliefs about money. Well, the interesting thing is that the way we get to our beliefs and how we land on our thoughts about certain things is really pretty simple, but yet very interesting, and psychologists tell us how it happens. According to psychologists, the way we get to the beliefs that we hold is that from childhood on, we begin developing beliefs based on one main thing that takes its form and shape in many different ways, and it's called experiences. That as you're a child and moving forward through life, and even as an adult, that the experiences that you have and the experiences I have basically become evidence that mentally lead us towards believing certain things. So as you are taught things, as you feel things, as you see things, all these experiences you have in life ultimately become evidence for you mentally that leads you toward the beliefs that you have. So the reason why you may think that politics is squeaky clean is because of the experiences that you've had. Everything to you has been clean, so you think, no, politics is good. Or if you think politics is just filthy and dirty and it's just a bunch of mudslinging, it's likely because of the experiences you've had with politics as well. The same could be said about marriage, about your beliefs of love, your beliefs on money, and all those things. Now, the other thing we know about belief is not only is it something that happens through our experiences and the evidences that we have, but we also know that belief not only touches us in the mind, but it reaches down into the soul of who we are. And it stirs our emotions, right? That whenever you believe something and you believe it passionately, it will stir you. Even to the point that when you see pictures, it stirs emotions based on your beliefs. And I'll prove it. We're going to do a little test today. Let's go ahead and put our first slide up here. In our first slide, you have, if you haven't been around in a while, our current president named Barack Obama, okay? Just in case you're kind of out of touch on the news. But what I know about you and about all of us is that when this slide pops up, you likely, some of you believe that he's doing a heck of a job. And whenever you see President Barack Obama in front of the American flag and you see that picture, because you believe he's doing a heck of a job, everything inside of you is positive about him. But what I also know is that there's others in here, and maybe that's a lot of us, I don't know, that when you see this image, you actually don't believe Barack Obama's doing a good job. You actually believe that he needs you on speed dial so that he could call you and you could tell him how to get this thing turned around, right? So when you see that image, your beliefs color the way you interpret this pic. Let's go to the next one. Here's a picture of a baby in the womb. And for some people, maybe here, maybe not, but some people, when they see this picture, they view this as a fetus. And that they don't believe that life begins until after this little one exits the womb, and that's when life begins. But there are others of us, and maybe many of us here, that when you see this picture, immediately you think, that's a life. And that's a life created in the image of God, and it's someone's little boy or little girl. Well, let's move to the next one. We're going to lighten it up a little bit. Here is Bigfoot, right? So when we see this picture of Bigfoot on the shore, some of us here possibly believe that this is the real deal, Bigfoot, right? And you're just waiting and sitting there waiting for the news to release that someone has discovered him and dragged him out of the woods, and here he is, and proved to the world that Bigfoot is real. But let's move to the next slide. Others of us may believe that this is the closest we will ever get to a real Bigfoot, right? Based on your experience, based on your evidence, this, Harry, and if you're too young to remember this movie, talk to your parents or grandparents. It's a classic movie. But Harry and the Hendersons, Harry may be the closest thing. Let's move to the next one. Aliens. You think about aliens. There are some people, and I don't know if you're in the room, that's okay, but look at pictures of aliens. It looks much like E.T. And you may look at this and say, hey, they're real. They abduct people, or maybe you think you've been abducted. I don't know. But then there are others of us that on the next slide that we believe this is the closest we'll ever get to an alien based on the experiences and the evidence that we have. Isn't that true? Now let's go to the next one. Now this one's in a totally different category. But see, pictures like this, whenever we see this, there are pictures of art, works of art depicting Yahweh or depicting God. There are possibly some of us, maybe many of us, maybe all of us here today, that when we see things like this, we say, based on our experience, based on our evidence, that God is real. Because we believe we've experienced God. We believe we have a relationship with God. We believe we know God. But there may be some in the room that actually take this other angle to where, based on your experience, based on your evidence, you believe that maybe there is no God. You see, guys, the issue about belief in God is, in my opinion, the most foundational, categorical belief that trumps all other beliefs that we carry around in our lives. It stands above all of them, and it has the greatest impact on our lives. And the reason why is this, is because if there is a God, then that means that at a minimum, that we all have to ask a series of questions. First and foremost is, if this God is there, what does that mean for me? And then secondly, is what am I to do in response to him if God is there? But also, it's a game changer as well for us if we say that God is not there, because if God is not there, then ultimately this is what it means. Is life is utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. And we're all just a cosmic accident. So the question about the belief in God is so important, it's so foundational that it shapes and influences everything around us. Well, personally, I want to share with all of you this morning that this is why we wrote this series. This is why I've written these 3 weeks of messages, is because that this is so important that we all need to, as individuals, figure out where we stand on belief in God. And in this series, I want to share with you just unapologetically that I personally believe that there is evidence that is staggering and overwhelming to say that there is a God. And so today I want to talk about that there is a God. Next week, I want to share with you who this God is. And then lastly, on Easter Sunday, I want to share with you how you can know this God personally. Now, to talk about today, the evidence for God, I want to talk about a subject. It's a skill. It's a focus that whenever I bring this up, I know it's immediately going to cause some tension in the room. And the reason why is because given your backgrounds and experiences, depending on where they fall, is that if you, in your level of education, have been exposed to science, then you have been taught and told certain things about science by scientists. And if you have been around church and in Christianity or any other type of religious type of movement, then you have been taught certain things about this. And what likely has happened in your life, like I know it has in mine, is that sadly, is that the individuals who speak about science oftentimes hold science up and says it trumps God. But on the other side of it, oftentimes in churches or other spiritual leaders, they hold God up and they say science is of little value and God trumps science. And so because of this, we have this tension, right? We have this tension over that God and science shouldn't even be mentioned in the same phrase. But I want to share with you today that I personally think that God and science actually are great to talk about together. Because it is my personal opinion that science actually points toward God, not away from God. And my belief is that God can be glorified. God can absolutely be seen more clearly through the study of science, and that science should be applauded, and science should be, the scientists that do the work should be thanked for the great work that they do. Now today I'm going to talk to you about two main arguments around science that point toward God. Okay? And these are fairly heady. I'm going to go ahead and admit that on the front end, and you may want to get your Advil ready. Okay? I've already taken mine after the first service. But these are two heady subjects, but these subjects here speak to, in my opinion, the evidence that says that God is there. And the first one I want to talk to you about is called the anthropic principle, or what is otherwise known as fine-tuning. And to introduce this to you, I want to share with you just a little history. Some of you know this, some of you, this may be news. But years and years and years ago, many, many scientists believed that the universe was infinite, meaning it had no beginning and no end. It's just always been. Now, for many of us in church, we think, well, that's God. Well, no, they thought that was the universe. Well, along comes a guy by the name of Hubble. You may have heard of the Hubble telescope, right? And Hubble one time was studying the space and looking out at the stars and the universe, and he was studying light. And as he studied light and studied the universe, he discovered something. He discovered that the universe was expanding. It's a scientific fact. It is expanding, meaning it's moving farther and farther out and apart. And as he looked at this, he said, oh my goodness, there's something we didn't know. And as he and all these other scientists started looking at it, what they found was this, is that they found that as you look at the expansion, you keep working backwards mathematically and scientifically, actually the universe has not always been. The universe had a beginning. It had a point in which it started, to which many Christians and theists and others said, we tried to tell you that, right? And as they looked at it, what scientists have pushed for many, many years now, and we'll put a picture up here, is that this starting point of when the universe began, they call it the Big Bang. You can call it whatever you want to do, whatever you want to call it. But they say that when it started, it actually started in a moment. And it had not been eternal. This was news for the scientific community and for the world. Well, what's interesting about this point in time, the moment in which everything came into existence and the rate of the universe's expansion, is that science also discovered something about this. Now, this is very intriguing. Is that the rate in which the universe expands, that if it were to get off just a little bit, then nothing would be here today. Okay? Now, you filter that through your grid on how all that works, but the point is that if this expanded a little faster or a little slower, nothing that exists today would exist today, was their point. And here's how fine-tuned they said that this really is. One physicist said this: had the universe expanded at a smaller rate than what it did, by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000. Now think about that. 100,000,000,000,000. That's, I don't even know how to do that. The universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present size. Here's the other one. Had it been greater, expanding greater, by even one part in a million, stars and planets could not have been able to form. So let me help make this a little clearer. I have one of my razor blade cutting knives, okay? And I'm not going to do anything with this, so don't worry. You have to say that nowadays, don't you? It's sad. But here's the razor blade. According to scientists, when all this came about and started in a moment in time, now however all that happened, we're not here to debate that today, is that had the universe expanded a little too fast, nothing would have been able to hold together. Had it expanded a little bit slower, then it would have recollapsed. In either case, nothing would be here today. So in essence, it's like the precision of the expansion of the universe sits on a razor blade and it doesn't tip left and it doesn't tip right. It just stays there. And today, life is here. Now, the reason why that's so interesting, especially if you're bored right now, is I'll tell you why it's interesting. Yeah, I'm just being honest with you. Is the reason why that's so interesting is this. It's because a lot of the arguments today about why there's no God is scientists will say, well, because of millions and millions and millions and millions of years. Now, they think 14 billion years ago, this event happened. And, you know, okay, fine. But they say over billions of years, anything can happen. They always punt to chance based on time. Here's the problem with that, with this. And let's just say that they're right. Let's just say Big Bang happens, all this stuff starts flying, and here we all are today. But I don't think it's that simple. But let's just say they're right. Is that had the time, the expansion, been off just a little to the left or a little bit to the right, it would not have even had enough time for all the other things they say happen to happen. Does that make sense? Guys, the precision of the universe, the cosmological constant, is staggering. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. Now, here's another way that physicists tell us how finely tuned the universe is. It's not only about the universe itself, but also life. We have a picture just put up here. Pretty blue marble, right? Planet Earth. That when you look at life on Earth, scientists say there are 30 constants, meaning laws in place, that make life possible. The axial tilt of the Earth, 23 point some odd degrees, right? The rotation of the Earth around the sun every 24 hours. Gravitational pull. All these different things that you could speak to, that if they are even tweaked or subtly maneuvered at all, life on Earth is completely, not a little, completely impossible. Let me give you an example. One of the physicists was asked about this, and he said, let me talk to you about gravity. He said, if you were to take an old radio dial, can y'all think back to an old radio dial instead of the push button stuff, and you were to just tweak it. He said, take a radio dial, take it in the universe, and go from one end of the universe to the other. Okay? It, just spread it out. And for every inch in the universe, now this is a lot of inches, right, that you put one of those little notches. He said, if you took the dial on the gravitational pull and you just moved it one inch in the entire universe, guys, not an inch here, universal inch, okay, very small, what would happen? He said, it'd be catastrophic. He said, it would absolutely shift gravity by a billion fold across the universe. Now, here, okay, big deal, right? What does that mean for us? What that means for you and myself is any animal the size of a human would immediately be crushed like a pancake. You would be crushed like a pancake. But for whatever reason, the gravitational constant, the gravity we have in our world, is set so precisely that life can exist. I could go on and on and on. One physicist who is not even a believer stated his thoughts about these constants as far as physics. And here's what he had to say. He said, the more I examine the universe and the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming. Think about it. The universe is absolutely set perfectly for life. And this physicist said, it had to know we were coming. It can't all just be like that. Now, next, I want to talk to you about something I've had a little fun with, and it has to do with biology. Any of you in here like biology? Yeah, I pulled out my old college biology textbooks, and I started reading the other day, and it asked a question that I want to ask you. I think it's kind of fun. Have you ever looked at a rock and looked at yourself and said, you know, what's the difference? Have you ever wondered that? Probably not. But anyway, that's what the book said. And if you have ever wondered what's the difference between you and a rock, then I'm going to help you with that, okay? There's a lot of differences between you and a rock, if it makes you feel better. Although some of you haven't moved at all. You're just, you know, you're like this. But here's the main difference. A rock is made up of atoms like you are. But you are made up of something that is absolutely incredible, and all living organisms are. And it's this. I'm going to put a picture up here. Cells. The human cell. To be specific about it, you as an individual are made up of actually 60 to 90 trillion of these suckers. And over 200 different kinds of them. To tell you how incredible that is if you were to take every human cell in your body alone, and you were to line them up side by side by side by side, okay, and they're microscopic, right? They're small. If you line them up side by side by side by side, you would stretch them around the earth 4.5 times from you or myself. And as scientists have looked at this, they've been blown away by the cell. But it was interesting, in the 19th century, scientists looked at the core, the center of it, it's known as the nucleus, and they really believed that the nucleus of the cell was kind of like Jell-O. I mean, it really wasn't a lot, too. It's just kind of a gobbledygook, you know, sitting in there, no big deal. But in the 20th century, things started changing. Scientists started discovering more and more stuff about the human cell. And here's what they ultimately discovered. In 1953, two scientists by the name of James Watson and Francis Crick discovered something pretty darn important. And I'll put the picture up here. DNA. That what they discovered was is that in the nucleus of each cell, of any living organism, is what you call DNA. The structure of DNA is a double helix. And here is, to make it simple as to what DNA is DNA is like the hard drive for human cells and ultimately for human life. It's like what they are. It holds all this code and all this instruction that makes you who you are. And all of the instructions in DNA are actually called genes or genomes. And what was interesting is that when they discovered this, they found out that if you took DNA, now think about this with me, out of one cell, microscopic cell, and you took it out and they're all folded up and you unfolded the DNA, DNA in one microscopic cell would stretch to 6 feet long. 6 feet out of one cell. It is absolutely crazy. And so within DNA, and you have RNA, which is like the flash drive, right? And then you have the instructions, the genomes. Along comes just in the past, I think, 10 or 15 years, a man by the name of Francis Collins. And Francis Collins is a believer in God. And Francis Collins led what is known as the Human Genome Project, where they went in and they studied and looked for and researched all the coding that makes up the human person through DNA. And here's what Francis Collins had to say about the human genome. He said, the human genome consists of all DNA of our species. The hereditary code of life. The code is 3 billion letters long. All cells, DNA, instructions that make you human, 3 billion letters of code. He said, written in a strange, in a cryptographic 4-letter code. He said, so amazing that a reading of the code at a rate of 3 letters per second would take you over 31 years to read it, even if you read it day and night. This code is so expansive, so fine-tuned, that if you read the thing for 31 years straight, 24 hours a day, then you could finally read it all. But let me give you a visual of how much this code is. He says, printing these letters out of this code in regular size font on normal bonded paper, binding them all together would result in a tower the height of this building, the Washington Monument, 555.5 feet tall. Now, when you look at this, and you look at the discoveries of science, you look at the expansion rate, you look at the gravitational pull, you look at the speed of light, the axial tilt, you look at even the complexity of human life, of cells, and DNA, and genomes, and all these things, you look at this stuff, it is staggering. And thankfully, the scientists that we have in the world have helped us see that. That's awesome, isn't it? Absolutely phenomenal. It leaves us in awe. And you see, the greatest thing about science is that science answers some questions for us. Science is absolutely really very, very, very beneficial in helping us with some questions. But also, science actually leaves some questions unanswered. And I want to share with you what those questions are. And I think the best way to tell you or to share this with you is to tell you by a story. Melissa and I have four kids, one on the way. And one of the children, our oldest son, Essen, when he was born, we recognized that he would get in the floor and he would take things and always try to put it together. I mean, he was always just trying to put stuff together with his hands. Maybe some of you are like that as well. I just like to figure stuff out. So we start buying him puzzles. And Essen would lay in the floor with his tongue hanging out of his mouth, and he would just sit there and with great precision put puzzles together. And we would just stand there and just go, wow, that was awesome. So I bought a puzzle, and I think this one's fitting for the discussion today. He would take pieces like this, right? If you haven't put a puzzle together in a while, I struggled with it personally. But he would take this puzzle. I don't know if you can see that. But he would finish his puzzle. To which after he finished his puzzle, we would sit there and we would look at it and we would just applaud for him, right? Going, dude, that's so awesome. You know, it was Lightning McQueen or, you know, whoever it was. And we'd say, man, that is so awesome. That is so cool. And you know what Esten did and what scientists do is that they figure out how this thing works and they paint a picture for us of how incredible things are. Now, not this monkey with, you know, bunny ears and a bouquet, but scientists, what they do is they take the things of the natural world, and they put things together for us and say, this is how it works. And we stand back and we say, unbelievable. But let me tell you two questions that science does not and cannot answer. Is that when you look at a puzzle and you look at all the pieces, how they're cut and how they fit together, anyone is naturally led in science, as you look at something masterful like that, to ask the question, why is it cut like that? Why is it cut to fit? Why does it work? Right? Science can tell you the how, but they can't tell you the why. The other thing that you're just naturally led to ask when you look at some beautiful scientific creation is that you're just led to ask naturally, where did it all come from? Where did the pieces of the puzzle even come from? You've told me how you've constructed this thing. It's awesome. But you can't tell me why they're like that. And you sure as heck can't tell me how or why or where they came from. So the how they answer, the why they can't, and the where it all came from, they can't answer it as well. Well, to take the examples we've talked about so far, about fine-tuning, and it just sitting on the knife of a razor blade as to how precise it is, when you look at those things and you back away from it, you say, unbelievable. And you look at the expansion of the universe, you have to ask this question. Why did it start and not waver at just the precise speed of expansion for this all to work out? Why did it not go a little slower? Why did it not go a little faster? Why did it not start just right and then go a little slower or a little faster? Why did it stay precisely where it needed to stay? Why did all these things form? And you could go on and on and on. But not only do you apply the why question, you can apply the where question. Where did the energy come from? Where did the matter come from? Where did everything come from in that example? Where did the gravity come from? Where did the planets come from? And as you back all the way up to the edge of science, and let's just say that's at the very beginning, at this point that they say it all started, and you ask the why and the where questions, they have some interesting answers, which we'll see in just a second. The same is true about biology. If you take life and you apply the why question and the where question, you can ask it this way. Why is it that we have 3 billion letters of code that make us who we are, that sits within a hard drive called DNA that makes and replicates cells for human existence? Why does that happen? Why is it that the first living organisms that came on the earth had the ability to reproduce? It implies purpose. It implies purpose driven. They knew they would die off, so they need to replace themselves. Why would that happen? And then lastly, I think just the simple question is, where did all of us as human beings and all the other living organisms come from? Are you guys with me? They can tell you the how, but can they tell you the where, and can they tell you the why? Now, when you face this question, every one of us, when we look at science, we stand on the edge of it, And we're honestly faced with that question, naturally, those two questions. And we need to have some type of answer. And we have answers for that, but also scientists and those that are atheistic scientists, not all scientists are atheists, but some atheistic scientists who say there is no God have answers as well. And so what I wanted to share with you just quickly is a quick video clip, and I want to tell you a little bit about this guy before we show you his clip. His name is Richard Dawkins. And Richard Dawkins is an atheist. He's written a number of books, The Blind Watchmaker, God Delusion, all this stuff. He's an atheist. He is a fire and brimstone atheist. He likes to slam all of us and tell us how stupid we are. And Richard Dawkins is about to give an answer to Ben Stein as to where it all came from, because he's really pushed on this question. But I'll tell you what Dawkins had to say that I find very intriguing before we show this clip. He said this about faith. He said, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and to evaluate evidence. So he said, really what you're doing is when you get to the edge of something and you say, I'm just going to have faith in something, is that you're copping out. You need to investigate and investigate more, and this is just a cop-out. And he says this, faith, being belief that isn't based on evidence, is the principal vice of any religion. Now that's what Dawkins has to say about faith and about belief. So I want you to listen quickly to Richard Dawkins as Ben Stein asked him very clearly, where did all this come from and how all this stuff works out? And let's watch this video. Now, I'll go ahead and readily admit, Richard Dawkins is a whole lot brighter than I am, okay? Especially in my little biological sketch I gave you a few minutes ago. But according to Richard Dawkins, the answer to the why and the where question is, if he's honest, he says, I don't know. We don't know. And then he says, no one knows. But when he was pressed to give an answer, the man who said basically faith is a great cop-out took a leap, didn't he? And his leap was towards maybe some alien life form that's just somehow, some way, came into existence, which again backs the question up further. It doesn't really answer anything, does it? And he ultimately says that it could have been an alien or it could have been chance. We don't know. Now, when you look at the evidence for science points clearly to these natural questions of why and where. And the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 1 to a group of Christians years ago about the biblical view or the view he had as moved by the Holy Spirit on this. And he said in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, let's look at these verses together. He said, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." Now here's the truth. "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things." You know, according to Paul, his answer is that when you look at science and the intricacies and the complexity and the fine-tuning, as he says, it is clear in what has been made, it's God. When Richard Dawkins has to give an answer, it's anything or anyone but God. And this brings about something that is just very simple, but it's true for all of us. Is as science leads us to the edge of science, and here we are standing at the beginning of time, however and whenever all that happened, and as we look at it and we ask the why and the where it all came from questions, we all ultimately have to take a leap of faith, right? Every one of us do. Richard Dawkins does. We do. All of us do. And to take the leap that Richard Dawkins took, to me, reminds me of this picture here, that you would have the amount of faith to believe you can jump across the Grand Canyon when looking at the evidence to believe, as he does, in either random chance or maybe an alien life form. But to believe that there's a designer, to believe that there is a God, by comparison, I believe the next slide illustrates the leap you have to take, is that you have to leap across a stream. And the question is which one's more reasonable? Is it more reasonable to say, no, let's leap towards chance and nothingness and hope it all works out? Or is it to follow the evidence and where it leads and to leap across the stream toward God? The psalmist had a personal opinion and seemingly a biblical God's opinion of this. And he said in Psalm chapter 53, verse 1, that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. You know, guys, the interesting thing about a fool is biblically is a fool knows what's true. The fool knows what's right, but they don't care. They say, whatever. And according to Paul in Romans 1 and even in Psalms, and based on the evidence, that the people who say, I'm going to try to leap the Grand Canyon versus leap the stream is a fool. And ultimately, they do not want for there to be a God over their life. So my question for you this morning is, which one's more reasonable, God or the alternative? And as you leap in this series, starting next week, we're going to describe and talk to you about who the God is that you're leaping toward. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for just another day. And God, I thank you that as we look at and study and talk about science, and as we look at and talk about just what's outside, even right now, the beauty of sunlight and the clouds and the refreshing breeze and all the things, God, that all of those things lead every one of us to just awe and wonder. And it leads us to questions like why and where. And God, I'm so thankful that you have made it abundantly clear that you are the why and you are the where it all came from. And God, I pray for all of us here this morning. Some of us struggle with these subjects and some of us struggle a little bit less. But God, I pray that you would encourage all of us. I pray for some here that today that are struggling with taking that leap, that God, that they would say, Father, I'm going to leap to you. Please catch me. God, I pray you'd give us a great rest of the week. And it's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.